So happy to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Always enjoy talking about the outdoors and especially the world of insects. We have so many great comments and questions every time we have Phil Pelletieri or P.J. Leash with us. And P.J. Leash is back today to talk about the bugs that are running around or flying around outside right now that you and I can see. And I know dragonflies and damselflies are certainly two that we're going to be talking about. But he's also ready to answer your questions and comments. I know we already have a Facebook photo up from Justin, and we'll be talking about it. It's a really cool photo of an insect he wanted identified. Maybe you have one of those, too. If you do, go to our Facebook page. The title of our Facebook page is The Larry Mueller Show. If you go there, you can post your photo and ask your question. You can also just phone us at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. We'd certainly love to hear from you. And P.J. Leash, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Pleasure to be here.
We have, I was talking about dragonflies and damselflies. What are the differences between those two, sort of?
Well, so in general, there's size differences. Dragonflies tend to be larger, and they have a more stout appearance. They're just overall thicker. Also, when they are sitting at rest with dragonflies, the wings sit out to the side, kind of in a T shape. Damselflies are a lot skinnier, narrower. They tend to be smaller, maybe an inch and a half, 2 inches long, but a very long, slender appearance. And in most cases, when they are sitting at rest, their wings are folded back kind of along towards the back end of the body. So they do have this very narrow appearance to them.
And I'm seeing both of them right now in my travels. I do my little 3 mile jog in the morning, and suddenly I'm seeing quite a few of them. Why this time of the year?
Well, this is just kind of the classic time that we see them. And it turns out in Wisconsin alone, we probably have about 150 and so different species of dragonflies and damselflies, if not more. And they are definitely a creature that they emerge. Some will emerge earlier in the spring, although this August is kind of the peak season that we see them. And if you are anywhere near a body of water, could be a pond, lake, river, stream, anything like that, there's going to be some type of dragonfly or damselfly.
Yeah, and we're right next to the water pretty much, so that's why we're probably seeing them. So that's kind of where they're most prevalent, I would guess then.
Yeah.
Are there good watching areas then? Just go to the water?
Yeah, in general, just go to some water. And dragonflies and damselflies are very fun to watch, and there's books written about looking at them through binoculars, similar to how folks watch birds with binoculars. But they have some interesting behavior. In a lot of cases, the males are territorial. And so they may have a certain twig off of a branch or a certain cattail that they like to sit on. And if another male comes into their territory, they'll go after it and chase it off and fend it off and kind of duke it out in midair sometimes. And so they are just really fun to watch.
Oh, that would be cool to see. So we've got dragonflies, damselflies. Let's talk about an insect that isn't so much fun to see, and that's the magnolia scale. Mm-hmm. Give us the background on that. I know you and I have talked about it before, but what is it and what's the problem?
Mm-hmm. So magnolia scale is just an oddball of an insect. As a matter of fact, it doesn't even really look like an insect. It looks more like a fungus. It has a white, fuzzy appearance. And normally this insect is found in pretty low numbers in the state. Last year, I think I had maybe one or two reports of it causing damage. But this year, during the month of July and August, I've been getting calls left and right about magnolia scale. And I work very closely with my colleague, Brian Huddleston, from the Plant Disease Diagnostic Lab. Folks often go to him first because they see these white, fuzzy lumps on the branches of magnolia. They think it's a fungus. It turns out it's an unusual insect. They're related to aphids, so they have basically a soda straw for a mouthpart. It's a long, tubular mouthpart. They poke that into the magnolia, and they are drinking the sap out of the tree.
Okay.
And when they do that, they end up spilling honeydew all over the place, so you can get ants, yellow jackets, and other insects attracted to it. The honeydew can drip down and lead to the growth of black sooty mold, so the leaves will actually have this black kind of fuzzy appearance to them, and that can interfere with photosynthesis. But for whatever reason this year, and I can't quite put my finger on it, magnolia scale has just been popping up left and right across the state and causing some problems for folks. The good news with that one, and it has an unusual life cycle, during most of its life, the insect is protected by a waxy coating as adults. But the juveniles can wander around whereas the adults just sit in place. And the juveniles are active right around this time of year. And so if you went up to a magnolia plant and popped off one of these little white blobs and looked underneath, and if I did this the other day speaking to a group of arborists, I had one in my hand, and you notice these little brown dots from underneath start wandering around. And so that tells us the juveniles are active. And so late August into early September is the time that we can go out and spray the branches on the tree if we need to.
And is there something that's fairly benign to spray?
Well, most of the garden and landscape sprays that you can get at the hardware store or garden center can be effective. You just have to make sure to follow the directions on the container and apply it to the branches of the magnolia tree.
P.J. Leash, our guest today from the University of Wisconsin Insect Diagnostic Lab. Join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Or again, if you want to post a photo, we usually get some really cool photos of insects on our Facebook page, and Facebook page titled The Larry Mueller Show. Speaking of that, Justin did send a photo in, a really nice one, actually. He said, I found this guy on my truck Sunday morning in the UP. I carried it around on my finger for a while, and then it zipped away. And what are we looking at there?
Well, so at the moment, I can't quite tell the exact species. And I mentioned we have well over 100 species of dragonflies in Wisconsin. If you included the UP, there's probably a few other ones up there that we might not have in our state. So I would have to head back to my office and peek in some of my books. There are some very good guides, and a husband and wife team out of Sauk City area, Carl and Dorothy Legler, actually have a book that they've published on the dragonflies of Wisconsin. So that's kind of my go-to guide for dragonfly identification. And also, if you hop online and do a Google search for Wisconsin dragonflies, there is a Wisconsin Dragonfly Society. And there's a website associated with them, and they have some great pictures of the dragonflies that we encounter in the state. So I'd have to do a little bit of digging to figure out the exact species in this case. You have to look at some fine veins and color patterns.
But no doubt it's a dragonfly, and I was thinking about the description that you gave earlier, and I thought, boy, that's right to a T. That's a dragonfly.
Exactly, yeah, the classic wing formation held out to the side.
Yeah, absolutely, and the head and so forth. Yeah, it's great. Thank you for sending that. Justin, appreciate it very much. Karen in Madison, it's your turn. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Thank you. I am in my car, and I don't have my camera, and so I'm going to do this from a very bad memory. But in my garden, I think it's on milkweed, butterfly milkweed plants, I'm noticing these multitudes of hatches of these little red bugs that grow very rapidly, but they start out sort of as this mass of tiny, tiny, bright reddish-orange bugs, and then they mature fairly quickly into some sort of beetle. But they seem to be in the seed pods, and I'm thinking it's on my butterfly milkweed, but it could be on lupine.
Okay. Well, with the description and the fact that it's on milkweed, we have a creature we call a milkweed seed bug. And they can actually look fairly similar to box elder bugs, although they are from a different family.
Yeah.
So I suspect it's probably not a beetle, but one of the true bugs. And what you are seeing, if they are mostly orange, these would be the juveniles or nymphs. And they do like to feed out on the pods of milkweed, butterfly weed, and related plants from the milkweed family. They are basically sipping some of the fluids out of the pods, although it doesn't really seem to affect the plants all that much.
So are they good to leave?
I mean, they're really not going to hurt anything. Plants seem to do fine, and milkweeds produce so many seeds that you could have hundreds of these things on a plant. The plant, for the most part, is nonetheless for the wear. You might have a you know, lower seed count in the pods, but overall they're just one of these things that is out there and very, very common on milkweed plants, especially this time of the year, but overall they don't seem to harm the plants much at all.
Okay, thanks. And what's the name again?
A milkweed seed bug.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Karen. Tom in Appleton up next. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Larry. Thanks. I got a question for PJ about a different group of member of the Arthropoda, and that is spiders. I do a lot of my work out in the field and meadow, and I have not seen one single orb weaver spider yet this summer. Usually about now is when we start to see them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about the big black and yellow. Yep. I don't know the genus, but where are they?
Well, they are still around. And as you mentioned, this is the time of the year when we start seeing some of the large orb weavers. There's a cross orb weaver and a number of other ones. And there are some that can be very, very large size. We're talking,
yeah,
with the legs included, maybe 2+ inches long. You often find them out in garden areas. And they can be kind of a whitish, yellow, greenish color on there. I've seen a few around, so that they definitely are there. But even if you look in the same spot, you might see them one year, you might not see them the next. So it can be kind of hit or miss, but they are definitely out there. I have gotten some calls and emails with pictures coming into the diagnostic lab.
Mm-hmm. So I'm in the Appleton area doing this work, and I'm literally walking fields and prairie plantings, and it's not usually a matter of finding one. It's like how many dozens were on me that day. I have not seen a single one.
And sometimes they can make some rather large prominent webs. The one that I found recently was on a milkweed plant, and it had just molted, so it was kind of a lightish color, and they're vulnerable at that point, and it was tucked on the underside of a milkweed.
Hmm.
So they are out there.
Yeah, okay.
All right, thanks, Tom. Appreciate the call. John in Janesville, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hey, good morning. My question would be pertaining to what role citizen scientists could have in entomology. Is there ways that sources information that we could find out what the scientists, people at UW might be wanting to, you know, what we're seeing in the field?
Mm-hmm.
Your eyes and ears.
Yeah.
Sure. Well, so we could go on and talk about that for probably an entire show, but a couple of good thoughts along those lines. One of my favorite websites is called bugguide.net, and that is a website where folks post pictures of insects, other arthropods such as spiders, millipedes, and the like, and they get identified. So it serves as kind of an online database, and we have records in there of what states things have been found in and that type of thing. And that is something that anyone can create an account and submit photos for. But a general recommendation would be to hop online and just do a Google search for citizen science project and put the word insect after it. I know there's all kinds of citizen science projects for pollinators like bumblebees and other native bees. There are projects for monarch butterflies and other butterflies. There are all kinds of butterfly surveys out there. So there's definitely all kinds of projects if you just hop onto Google and start doing some internet searches for
them. There we go. All right. Thanks a lot, John, for calling. Appreciate it. And Paul in Hartford, your turn. Hi, Paul.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Two quick questions. I have about an acre and a half of prairie, and I am just infested with these Japanese beetles. Are they an invasive species?
So technically they are. Japanese beetles aren't found everywhere in Wisconsin. They've been around for a couple of decades. Originally, though, they do come from East Asia. They got into the country in New Jersey area about 1916, so next year will actually be the 100th anniversary of their arrival.
Okay.
But they do get into areas, and the pattern we see in the state, because I mentioned they aren't everywhere yet, when they first get to a spot, they tend to be very, very damaging. And the analogy I like to make is it's almost like a wildfire. When it first gets there, cause a lot of damage. After 5-10 years, it's more of a slow smolder. But they are definitely, they have an invasive component because they move in and they can really cause some damage.
Is there any effective control for these Japanese beetles? I mean, some of these trees literally look like they're dying.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are products out there that we can use to protect plants. It all depends on the type of plants. There are some products that can be used for larger trees, and some trees like birches in particular really
get
hammered.
They're starting to destroy some birch trees in the backyard. So
yep.
I think they're called Lindenwoods.
Yep.
And I've never seen anything like it. I was going to get the chainsaw out to take the trees down, and then mm-hmm. I realized I shook the tree and I had these beetles just landing on top of me. It was almost disgusting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, And have you noticed them in the past, or does it just seem like in this year they're particularly bad?
Not really. I mean, it's just an explosion this year. Mm-hmm. And the other question I have, are there chiggers in Wisconsin?
Yes.
Yes.
We do technically have chiggers. They don't seem to be terribly common. But if you are out and about, especially wandering through perhaps grassy areas, folks do encounter chiggers from time to time.
I haven't. And, you know, I wouldn't give up on those birch trees either. I mean, I just make sure they've got plenty of water and that going into the winter. And would you, PJ, I don't know, anything else?
Well, a general recommendation is just make sure to maintain the health of the tree. So as Larry mentioned, making sure it has water. Most trees, they can withstand a defoliation 1 year. If it happens year after year after year, then over time the trees are weakened, other insects can get in. So I would just keep a general eye on it. If it dries down again, make sure it gets enough water so that it is as healthy as can be going into the winter. And then hopefully next year, the beetles may be a little bit lower in your area. And overall this year, we have more Japanese beetles than last year, although I'd say statewide, if we took a long-term average about the last decade or so, reports seem to be down this year or a little bit below average.
I was looking at, you know, the grape leaves, the grapevines where, you know, were decimated years back are now, I think I saw like two Japanese beetles on those grapevines this year. And I mean, they used to be just gone.
Yeah.
Defoliated.
As I mentioned, when they first pop in your area, they can wreak all kinds of
really
havoc.
Cool.
And then 5 years later, you barely find any of them.
So good luck, Paul. And thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. PJ Leash, our guest today. From the University of Wisconsin Insect Diagnostic Lab, I'm Larry Mueller. Cheyenne Lentz, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking the world of insects with PJ Leash today. Larry Mueller here. Thanks so much for joining us. Questions, call at 800-642-1234. Photos, post them on our Facebook page, the title, The Larry Mueller Show. That's where you should go. And speaking of that, some nice, really cool photo on our Facebook page. If you're listening and you have access to a computer, go to it and type in The Larry Mueller Show, and under visitor posts, this is the coolest insect that Jeff and Mary sent. Jeff sent from Dorchester, Iowa, and it looks like almost like a turtle.
It definitely does, and we actually call these insects tortoise beetles because they do have that very rounded appearance, kind of like a turtle shell. They're technically from the leaf beetle family, the family Chrysomelidae, and we do have a few species that pop up in the Midwest on a variety of plants. Now, one of the things that is really neat about some of these insects is they have the ability to change color a little bit. They have some transparent regions of their body, and they can shunt basically the insect blood through it and do some other things. And so they can change colors, and some of them are a very, very brilliant golden color like we can see in the picture, but it's a type of tortoise beetle.
And this one has looks black almost with some bright green, almost like a Japanese writing on it. It's really cool.
Yeah, they are definitely some neat creatures. I don't run into them all that often, but they are out there, and if you keep an eye out for them, you can definitely spot them.
And here we've got another one from Char. We're doing an art fair in Evanston, Illinois by Lake Michigan. There were thousands of these flying, and I bet I had 20 of them resting in my booth. Very cool.
Yeah, so this one happens to be one of our easiest dragonflies to identify, and it can also be one of the most common ones, and it appears to be what we call the green darner. They have a green thorax, and their tail on the body is a brilliant blue color.
Pretty good size, too, for that matter.
Yeah, they are one of our largest dragonflies, and they can have a wingspan of probably about 5 inches, maybe even close to six if you had a big one.
Jake in Milwaukee has a question. Hi, Jake. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just recently got my mosquito and aquatic pesticide license from the state, so I've learned enough to talk myself into a corner when I'm speaking with my customers. I understand that Wisconsin is host to a number of species of mosquitoes. I was wondering if BJ would be able to tell me what some of the most common ones are and a little bit about them so that I may know how better to possibly combat them.
Mm-hmm. Well, in a good general recommendation, if you went out there and did an internet search for mosquitoes of Wisconsin, our medical entomologist in the department, Susan Paskowitz, has a good website that kind of talks about the species we have around. So that's a great source of information. In general, we like to think of mosquitoes in kind of these functional groups in terms of how they breed. So we have some that we call the floodwater mosquitoes. And these mosquitoes are ones that lay their eggs in shallow depressions out in the woods. And those eggs can sit there, in some cases, for a couple of years without hatching. They are simply waiting for lots of rain to come, and that often happens in the spring. And that's why in the spring, if we get dumped on with rain, about 2-3 weeks later, we get a big explosion of mosquitoes. So we have the floodwater group. Then we have some mosquitoes that breed more in permanent bodies of water. A common species from this group, Culex pipiens, is one of them that can be associated with diseases like West Nile and some other things. And so they like to breed more in permanent bodies of water, not these depressions out in the wood that fill with floodwater. But overall in the state, we have over 50 different species of mosquitoes. And so each species has their separate habits and places they like to lay eggs and distances they can fly and that type of thing. So the Mosquitoes of Wisconsin website is a great resource that'll kind of summarize a lot of that information.
Yeah, thanks, Jake. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Mike in Greenville, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Appreciate the call.
Yeah, I have an issue with box elder bugs. Usually when there's, you know, a lot of sun hitting the south side of my home.
Yep.
And just wondering how to manage them.
Sure.
And this is getting to be about the time of the year, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Very shortly, if these insects haven't started moving in, we're going to have box elder bugs, cluster flies, conifer seed bugs, a number of things are going to be getting in. And they often like to congregate on the southern facing sides of home simply because it's sunnier, it's a little bit warmer. They can sneak in through cracks around soffit areas, doors or windows where there's maybe a little gap in the siding or doors or windows don't seal properly, that type of thing. So a couple of thoughts on what to do about them. If you inspect the south and western facing sides of your house, make sure that any cracks or gaps are sealed up to physically keep them out. That's an important step. But if you do see them on the siding, it's a fairly routine thing for pest control companies to come out, and you can hire someone to come out, and they can treat the siding on your house. So if the insects start congregating on it, that is going to take care of them before they move indoors and prevent problems later on in the winter or following spring. Another thought, if you see a lot of them, you can go out with insecticidal soap or even soapy water. Mix an ounce or two of dish soap with a gallon of water. You can spray that on the box elder bugs, and it'll kill them.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And of course, if you can ever figure out a way to tighten up every little crack on the south side of your house, that's going to, you know, eventually solve your problem, at least in terms of them getting in.
Yeah. Now, a little bit of good news when it comes to box elder bugs this year. So box elder bugs seem to do best when we have dry conditions. So if you think of a year like 2012, that was a great box elder bug year. When we have wet years with lots of rain and moisture, there's some diseases that pop up and keep their populations in check. So I've seen a few box elder bugs, but in general, I think their numbers are down compared to years a couple years ago.
No. Sort of along with that, Dave emailed us to say, after many years of plucking Japanese beetles from my garden, I have realized that I have not seen a single one this summer. And that kind of goes along with what you were saying earlier. They're in force for a while, and then they kind of back off.
Yeah, well, and another thing that may be tying into this. So Japanese beetles spend the winter as white grubs in the soil and turf grass areas, and the females love to lay eggs in turf grass areas. So golf courses, cemeteries, parks, any place with a lot of turf grass, you can have the grubs. Typically, the grubs move deep enough in the soil to avoid the frost line, so they might go down 8, 12 inches or so. But if you think back, and it might be painful memories for some folks, but the brutal winter a year and a half ago. It got down minus 20. Towns were telling folks to leave the water running because that frost was creeping so deep. I think that got down deep enough that it kind of zapped their numbers and killed a lot of them. So last year, Japanese beetle numbers were down statewide. Yeah, there were a few cases of damage here and there. They've rebounded a bit because there were survivors out last year. They can lay a lot of eggs. But overall this year, I say they're below average. Hopefully, they're not going to creep back up next year.
On to Gary in Mellon next. Hi, Gary.
Hi. Hi. I've got a tree in the backyard that it looks kind of like a rain tree. But, you know, it's got kind of long leaves. And some of the leaves are starting to turn brown and curl up. I know that spiders or some insect in there. And the other thing with the tree, there's like black mass on some of the branches that looks kind of like foam or something, but it's harder.
Yeah. So on the underside of the leaves?
No, it's right on the top. Right on the branch itself.
Oh, okay.
Okay. And do you happen to know what type of tree this is, Gary?
It looks like years ago they had, or maybe still do, house plants. They call them rain trees.
Okay. Okay, I guess I'm not familiar with that one. I'd have to dig in the literature a bit. So a couple thoughts on the situation, though. Are these occasional leaves that are curled up, or is it kind of widespread in the canopy of the tree?
No, it's a small tree, but it's the leaves on the end of the branch. The leaves, you know.
Yeah.
So, 10 inches on the end don't get it, but 10 inches onward, it just makes the leaves curl up. They look almost like a tobacco color.
Okay. Mm. Okay. Well, there are some insects that we call leaf rollers that are small caterpillars that take silk and they basically roll the leaves up. Although they usually stay fairly green, there are also some small caterpillars and other insects that are leaf miners. If you think of the leaf as an Oreo cookie, they basically live in that frosting layer. So they are very, very tiny. They chew out the inside of the leaf, and it can turn brown and kind of shrivel up a bit. But there could be a number of possibilities. One thing you could do is send a sample into my diagnostic lab, and I'd be happy to take a peek at it. There's also a possibility that it could be disease-related. There are a number of diseases that can do weird things to leaves, cause them to turn brown, curl up, and that sort of thing. So we'd have to see a sample to narrow this one down farther, I think.
And so if you do that, you'd want to get one that is not completely dead. Hopefully you've got some that are sort of in the process that you could send. And you would send those. You wouldn't send them on like a Friday.
No.
You'd probably want to send them during the week, wouldn't you?
Yeah, best to send them on probably a Monday or a Tuesday so that they get here, say, Thursday, Friday, and they're not going to sit in the post office over the weekend.
Yeah, and so the University of Wisconsin Insect Diagnostic Lab, mm-hmm. and I think we have a link to that on our Facebook page. Yeah, Cheyenne's saying, yeah, we do. And okay. So you can get the address right off our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Mm-hmm. Well, it's fairly easy anyway.
Yeah, 1630 Linden Drive, room number 240. And Madison, Wisconsin, 53706 for the zip code.
Yeah. And if you didn't get that, it's all there on our Facebook page. Just a quick look at back. We've got now a ton of photos. Cindy sent a really nice one. That's a beautiful one. She said, this one was in my basement. The cat had it on the floor. We rescued him, set him outside. He disappeared about an hour later when I checked on him.
Mm-hmm.
So, nice green, bright green.
Yeah, I think this looks like another case of the green darner, which I mentioned can be one of our largest and most common dragonflies. They have a brilliant green color on
really
the thorax.
Pretty.
And the posterior and the kind of tail end of the body tends to be a bluish color.
Yep, pretty one. And then Brittany sent us another one. Cecropia and Polyphemus moth caterpillars from Dane County, Wisconsin.
Ah, very cool. And there are folks out there that collect these, rear them to adults, get eggs and rear them, and it's really fun to watch.
And they're a bright green color right now.
Yeah, and they are amongst our largest caterpillars. They can get to be good 4+ inches long when mature caterpillars.
Yeah. And here's a Kyle sent us a really cool picture. He said, this is the box my dad made to raise monarch butterflies. And it's a really cool box. If you're ever interested in that, you ought to take a look at the photo. You could probably figure out how to do it yourself from the photo. He's reared 26 so far this year and released them. He has 48 combined chrysalis and caterpillars waiting to transform.
Oh, that's neat.
Isn't that cool?
There are fact sheets out there through websites like Monarch Watch and a number of other citizen science websites that give you instructions on how to do it. It's a fairly basic process, and my wife and I are actually rearing some monarchs out at the moment. We should be getting adults here in the next couple of days, but it's fun. It's a great project if you have kids or grandkids at home to get them involved and learning, and it helps out the monarchs, too. It turns out monarch caterpillars have kind of a tough life, and from egg to adult stage, very few actually survive. Mortality is probably over 90%, so if you find them and rear them, it gives them a better chance.
And here's a really cool one, a large milkweed bug eating butterfly weed seed pods, and this is kind of the color of the University of Illinois, orangish. Wouldn't you say in black?
Yep. So this is the one I was referring to earlier. They sometimes call them milkweed seed bugs. There's a large milkweed bud, but they do resemble box elder bugs, although more of an orange than a red color. And they can be very, very common this time of the year feeding on milkweed seed pods.
Very pretty. Very pretty. Video of a large caterpillar that Patty found yesterday. And so I don't know if we can. Oh, there it is. Oh, my goodness. Look at that thing crawling through the grass.
Well, that one I don't recognize off the top of my head. It appears to be pretty good sized. I'd have to dig in my caterpillar books. There are a number of species that feed on plants as caterpillars, and when they're getting ready to pupate, they go down and become a pupa in the soil. So I wonder if that may be what's going on, as it has left its plant, and it may be trying to get down into the soil or another sheltered spot to pupate.
Looks like something from a science fiction.
Yeah.
As a really cool video. Thank you, Patty, for sending that. I really appreciate it. Let's see if we've got any more quickly. No, we'll just let's go back to the phones here. And Don in Warren, Illinois, has a question or a comment. Let's go to Don. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. This is a success story. I've been listening to your program. About a year ago or a little more, you had Phil Politeri on, and he mentioned that yellow jackets were a big problem to all of us. And he said that they fixate on a certain product. So I kicked that around in my feeble old brain for a while and said, okay, they love orange pop. You can buy a 2-liter bottle of orange pop for a little over $1. So I put open dish out and filled it with orange pop and kept it filled. I'm a beekeeper. And the yellow jackets rob out my bees. And at several dollars a pound, it's far cheaper to get them to go into the orange soda and stay out of the beehives. And it worked perfectly last year. So if you've got problems, divert the beasts and get them into going into something that they will take. And I just kept that pan full, and they drank and let everything else alone. And it was sure worth the problem solved.
Oh, yeah, especially for $1 or so for some orange pop.
Oh, yeah, I bet you can probably go to a dollar store and pick up a 2-3 liter bottle of pop pretty cheaply. And there is truth behind that. So it turns out with yellow jackets, you can get them attracted to a certain food, but they have an unusual habit. They kind of like certain things, and if you get them hooked on it, they ignore other food sources. And so if you can get out there early in the season, get them used to coming to the orange soda, and you can, you know, tuck that in a corner somewhere and keep them away from picnic areas or beehives, you may be able to work with the pop trick and keep them off of where you want them to leave alone.
Great idea. And Don, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. It's very cool. Very cool idea. Donna in Hartford has a question. Hi, Donna.
Yes. Hi, good morning. Thank you. I love all of your nature programs.
Thank you.
So a couple of weeks ago, I came out to my car late one night, and there was this bug, and I'm almost 50 years old, and I've never seen it ever in my life. It looks like, I should call it an insect. It has six legs that have very prominent bends, you know, like little knees, and then it has like a little foot. You remember the game Cootie? Well, this insect has legs like the Cootie does. Thing did. It kind of goes out, makes a little L, and then comes down and has this little foot. Okay, and the body of it, the entire thing is bright green, and the body of it looks like a pea, like a snap pea.
Yeah.
And it moves incredibly slowly, but then I learned it actually has wings. It's about an inch and a half, 2 inches long at most.
That's a pretty good description.
And it has like a little shield on its back. If you get real close to it, it looks like a little piece of, like I said, like a shield, kind of a triangular piece that looks like wood. So it would really blend in with any tree that it was sitting on.
So based on the description, it sounds like you ran into what we call a katydid. These can be very common this time
of
year.
That's what came into my head right away.
Yeah. I've been seeing quite a few of them. They often will show up at porch lights, and it's not uncommon to see one or two wander on a porch light at night. I had been doing some black light trapping for moths at my own place, and a couple would show up every time I had the black light trap on, but they can be good size. And these are some of the insects that make all kinds of noises at night. And there are actually books out there that come with an audio CD, and there's websites too. I believe University of Michigan or Michigan State has one. And if you just Google search night sounds of insects, you'll probably find a website, and you can learn to identify the insect species at night based on the type of calling noise that it's making. So they're fascinating creatures.
Wonderful. Yeah, I was parked underneath a streetlight, so that would make perfect sense.
Yep, there you go.
Oh, well, that's fabulous. Always heard of katydids, never knew what they looked like. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Donna. Thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. Bob in Fifield. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
Well, I was wondering, I've been out just today walking down the road, and it seems like there's an awful lot of gnats around. I think they're gnats. They're flying insects, very small, grouped together, and they bug the heck out of you. And I was wondering if this is an unusual season for them, or if it's, it doesn't seem like it's common, because I've been here for about 8 years, and I've never noticed it as intense as it has been this summer.
Yeah.
Okay, well, couple thoughts come to mind, and when we use the term gnat, that can be a fairly generic term. There's all kinds of tiny flying insects. Some are true flies, some could be from other groups, and folks often just commonly call them gnats. And to be honest, for most of them, you've got to get them under probably 20-30x magnification to really tell them apart. And if you'd want, and you could collect some in a jar, you can send them in, we can figure out. Some of the thoughts, if you are near a body of water, they could be from a group we call midges or lake flies, which can kind of fly around in good numbers sometimes. There are fungus gnats that can be associated with decomposing plant matter, rotting logs, mushrooms, and things like that. They can pop up in good numbers. And if we have damp conditions, and we have had a decent amount of rain lately, sometimes you can get fungus gnats popping up outdoors, but there's a lot of possibility. So I'd have to see a sample to figure out exactly what you're seeing a lot of, and then we'd be able to understand why you might be seeing a lot of them.
And so if you have some, why post to the Insect Diagnostic Lab again, and we, BJ, not me, BJ will have hopefully have an identification for you. Thanks again for calling. Appreciate your call. I'm Larry Mueller, PJ Leash from the Insect Diagnostic Lab at the University of Wisconsin. Our guest today with the Department of Entomology at UW-Madison. Here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Larry Mueller. Cheyenne Lentz, our on-air producer. Thanks so much for listening in here on the Ideas Net as we talk insects with PJ Leash from the University of Wisconsin Department of Entomology and the Insect Diagnostic Lab. call in. Well, all our lines are filled right now. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Post your photos or insect photos and or questions on our Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show for that. And PJ, just looking here on the Facebook page, another photo, this one from Owen, a nice shot of a damselfly near cornucopia.
And as far as damselflies go, this is probably one of my all-time favorites. The body, it's a little hard to see in the picture because it's a little bit dark, but it tends to be a very metallic-y turquoise color with black wings. So it's just a neat-looking insect. It's from a group we call the jewel wings. There's one species called the ebony jewel wing, and there's a few other related ones, but jewel wing damselflies are very, very neat creatures.
Really pretty. And again, as you if you go online, you should go online to see all the photos that we have on our Facebook page right now, the insect photos. Go to the Larry Mueller Show page and then look over on the left side, and there's something called visitors posts. And if you click on that, that's where you're going to see all the photos. And I'll click and see if we've got some more. I bet we have some more already. Pete in La Crosse up next with a question. Hi, Pete. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry and PJ. I've read recently about tick tubes, which are intended to help kill the deer ticks on mice and stop the Lyme disease cycle. I have a couple questions. Should PJ talk about tick tubes and then come back with my questions?
Sure, sure. So I'm only vaguely familiar with tick tubes. I suspect it's probably a type of tube with an insecticide in there and something to attract the mice. So they go in, they get a little bit of insecticide on them, and then that hopefully eliminates some of the ticks. And Susan Paskowitz in our department, our medical entomologist, she actually has some folks in her lab working on this type of project to see what impacts that has on tick populations.
Okay, yeah, they put cotton balls in them with permethrin on them.
Mm-hmm.
And so my questions were, does this sound like a good idea for western Wisconsin? What time of year should I put them out? And how close or far apart should they be spaced?
Well, so those are some good questions. And to be honest, I haven't seen a whole lot of research done on some of those topics in terms of best time of year to put them out, spacing, that kind of thing, and overall how effective they may be. So I think the jury is still out on some of that.
No, okay. And Susan might have, she may have posted something.
Yeah, and she does have a Wisconsin Ticks website. So I would definitely recommend doing a Google search, finding that, and she may have some additional information on there.
So if you go to just type in Wisconsin Ticks,
It should pop up, yeah, if you did an internet search for that.
And it'd be UW Susan Paskowitz.
Yeah.
That'd be the one. There you go, Pete. Thanks a lot for calling. Marcus in Green Bay, your turn now. Hi, Marcus.
Well, I have a nighttime insect. I wrote down that site that you had just after I got off the phone with the screener. I used to think it was a tree frog, but they started up about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and the best way to describe the sound is it's like a cricket sound, except in slow motion and a lower tone. And they're real, you know, nice to hear, and they're scattered about, and they seem to be in a tree, lower tree, and, you know, one will do it here, and then another one over there. And I don't know if that's a good way to describe it, but can you help me out on that?
Mm-hmm. Well, without listening to it, I can't narrow it down that much. There are dozens of different species of katydids, and another group that we call the tree crickets, and they can also make noises at night. So if you're able to get a digital sound recording that you could perhaps email to me, I can narrow it down from that, but there's dozens of different possibilities.
Okay, I might be able to do that. And what was the first one you said, the first possibility?
Katydids and tree crickets are the two groups that I'm thinking
great.
Of.
All right, thanks a lot for calling, Marcus. Ken in Mayville, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, we have a huge garden, and every year we plant lots of sunflowers. And seems like this year we have these beetles all over the sunflowers. They resemble the shape of a firefly, but they have yellow stripes instead of red, and they don't seem to have the little fluorescence on the bottom. Wondering if you had any idea what they might be.
Okay, so when I see or hear of kind of slender firefly-like beetles this time of the year that are yellow with black stripes, we have something we call a goldenrod soldier beetle. and they can be very, very common. They show up to flowers, and they are there to feed on the pollen as a protein source. And if you're in the right spot, you can just see hundreds of them in a flowered area.
Very cool. There you go. Thanks, Ken. And John, in calling from Virginia. Hi, John.
Hello. Hello. Glad you could have me on, Larry.
Sure.
Yes, I'm working for, I'm doing a contract for APHIS and Department of Agriculture, and I'm up here in Wisconsin right now checking, looking for the emerald ash borer beetle. I was wondering why I keep running into a lot of landowners, and people are not very aware of this bug and what this bug is doing, and people are cutting their ash trees, you know, thinking that this bug is going to come in and just devastate everything. And I was just mainly wanting to get the information, try to help get a little more information out to some of these other people that are listening, that we need to keep as many ash trees as we can right now because of this bug.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you bring up some great points, John. Emerald ash borer is an invasive species that got into the state back in about 2008, and it is just going to, you know, do a number on our ash trees. And the estimate I've seen, we have well over 700 million ash trees in the state that could be at risk. If you have a couple trees in your yard, there are effective treatments to protect them. If you have a woodlot area with hundreds of ash trees, then we have to think about some other things because we just can't treat large areas. But at this point, the southern half of the state is quarantined for emerald ash borer. We're up to about 39 counties quarantined. And out of 72 counties in the state, we're over halfway there for the state being quarantined. So southern half of the state, Door County, up towards Rhinelander area in Oneida County, Superior area in Douglas County. So it's definitely around. Overall, my impression is that awareness is a lot better now than what it was 3, 4, 5 years ago. But there are still folks that maybe just haven't heard the news on this insect. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and it's... You can. I was going to say, as just to go along with what PJ said, there are effective treatments that won't break the bank. If you've got a really nice, ash tree, mm-hmm. you know, you can save it.
Yeah, there are options that homeowners can do themselves. There is also the option to hire an arborist. Arborists do have some different compounds that they can use, and some of those products can actually provide multiple years of protection, 2 to 3 years of protection, if not potentially longer. There's some research going on with that. To treat an individual tree in your yard might be $20 to $50 a year, depending on the type of treatment, but as you said, Larry, it's not going to break the bank. And if you think about property values, trees can be a high value thing.
Absolutely.
They can provide shade, do a lot of good things. So if you got some good looking, healthy ash trees, we do have effective ways to protect them.
Yeah. Thanks, John.
Thank you. Yeah, there are some beautiful ash trees in these people's yards. And I mean, they do make a great tree. And I thank you so much for helping get that information out there for me.
All right. Thanks, John, for calling. Appreciate it very much. So John was working with APHIS. And APHIS is
the associated with the USDA, the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service.
I was trying to remember the acronym, and then I thought, oh, no, I put it on PJ to come up with it, but you came up with it. Excellent. Oh, man. Russ in Eau Claire. Hi. Thanks for calling.
Yeah. Hey, Larry. I have a little story for you more than a question. This is a hornet redemption story from the weekend. You know, the kids had done battle with some hornets, paper wasps, ground nest, and a couple of kids got stung, and then it was, hornets are bad, and then we're sitting in the canopy, and we have a bunch of flies and smaller bugs flying around, and we had these big black hornets come in, and they would just pick off the flies and the small bugs one by one, and so I got to do a little reading, and it was a bald-faced hornet. And so it was kind of like we ended up starting to hate the hornets, and then we ended up liking them at the end of the weekend. So more of just a comment and a story about the bugs around us.
That's a cool story, isn't it, BJ?
That is, yeah.
I love that. Thank you, Russ. Appreciate it. And Julie and Amory, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you. So this beautiful weather, we're out on decks, and I was at a establishment that had an outdoor deck with food and beverages, and hanging on the side of the building were Ziploc bags with water and pennies in them. And I asked, what was that for? And they said, it's to keep the flies away. And I didn't realize until they said that, that there hadn't been any flies out on this open deck. And I'm just wondering, why does that work?
Well, so I've heard of this trick before, where you have a bag with water, a clear, transparent bag, you put some pennies or coins in there. Perhaps there is something a little bit with reflective properties, although I haven't seen any actual research showing that it works. So I think it may be one of these things that folks put up. Maybe there's fewer flies, but could it just be a coincidence? I think that may be what's going on.
Yeah, that's one that I'd like to see any research done on that one, because... Well, that's the first I've heard of it, though. Julie?
Well, it's kind of interesting in that it doesn't cost you much. It, you know, looks kind of funny, but it doesn't, you know, it doesn't cause any trouble. And
yeah.
I thought, well, you know, I'd try that at home someday, but I just wondered if there was research behind it. Well, one, thank you so much for your
Yeah, time. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate it. And thanks so much to all of people who are sending in photos on our Facebook page. Look at this one from Ed, a damselfly, I think, bright fluorescent blue.
Yep, so this one is indeed a damselfly, and you can tell because the wings are folded back along the body. We have a group of damselflies that we commonly call the bluets, and there's actually a whole bunch of species. So I'd have to sit down with a book to potentially narrow it down, and some of them, the color changes can be so subtle that you almost have to... have them in hand and look at them under up close under the microscope, or have some up close pictures to really tell the species apart.
Well, we have some really beautiful shots here, which we'll talk about later on the show. We're going to take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net, and then we will be back with PJ Leash. You stay with us. So happy to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we take a look at the world of insects here in Wisconsin. With P.J. Leash, who has a degree in biological sciences and entomology from UW. He manages the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, of course, associated with the Department of Entomology, or member of it. So, great to have him along. Questions from you? Call 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And lots of great photos. We'll get to some of those. But I wanted to take an email from Dave in Bristol, PJ, who said, I've lost several mature oaks over the last few years. And yesterday I cut one down and noticed several small moths in the area. Are any species of moths responsible for oak tree deaths? And it's probably oak wilt would be my guess is the disease issue.
Yeah, so when you get dead and dying oaks, it can be tricky sometimes. We do have a disease, oak wilt, that can take them out. There is an insect, two-line chestnut borer, which can get in sometimes and kind of finish a tree off. In terms of moths, the only moth that might cause significant damage to oaks that we'd see regularly is gypsy moth, which has been down for a couple years. So my suspicion, these little moths you're seeing in the area are probably just a coincidence. There's a number of tiny moths and even some good-sized ones that will hang out on the bark of trees or under the bark of trees if the bark is kind of loose to kind of hunker down for the day, and they're active at night. But I think it's simply a coincidence.
If Dave in Bristol, you might want to look under oak wilt disease and take a look at that. There's a lot of information out there on the web, and you know there are potentially ways to control it. But if you've got a forest kind of oak trees, it's going to spread probably by the roots,
mm-hmm.
and it's a difficult thing to control for sure. We have a photo from Joseph Allen. What kind of insect is this? It's in a purple background and, again, a kind of an orangish-looking bug there. What have we got?
So this is the larva or juvenile stage of a lady beetle. Lady beetle, as both larvae and adults, are predators of aphids, small soft-bodied insects like caterpillars. So they're actually great to have around because they feed on all kinds of pests.
Johnny sent us one. This thing landed on me while canoeing on the Little Wolf River, looking menacing, but actually pretty docile. And it does look a little menacing, I guess, if you take a look at it.
Yeah, so this is one of our biggest wasps in the state. And we have a group we call the giant ichneumon or ichneumonid wasp. And the insect itself can be about 2+ inches long. And this one happens to be a female. The long tail coming out the back end, despite looking like a stinger, it's not. That's a special egg-laying device. And the female will actually drill into a rotting tree. And she lays her egg on another insect that's in there. And her larva is a parasite of the insects living in the woods. So they're fairly common and out in the woods and associated with rotting trees. And it looks like we have another picture.
Yeah, Bill sent a really beautiful one. Looks like it's getting ready to bore into the tree.
Exactly, Larry, yeah. So this is a picture of a female, and we have a couple species that are kind of reddish and yellow, and that's
beautiful.
Exactly what's going on. This is a female. She's getting ready to drill, and what's interesting is for part of her life, that egg-laying device is actually coiled up inside her body. And so when she is uncoiling it, it does some bizarre things. There's a whitish membrane that pops out. It looks like something out of an alien movie, and then she starts drilling into the wood.
It is very, very cool. And let's just maybe get one more here. We've got a caterpillar question from Sarah. It looks like this is a very interesting looking caterpillar. This guy, she says, seems to have a fake face on its back, complete with a little mouth that sticks out its tongue when you touch him.
Yep. So this is the caterpillar of one of the swallowtail butterflies, specifically one of the tiger swallowtails. Sometimes they are greenish, sometimes more of a dark color, but they can have these eye spots on them to perhaps startle predators that might be coming to try and eat them. And also, if you disturb them, there's this gland that pops out of their body. It looks like a forked snake tongue, and it's covered with some nasty chemicals, so they have all kinds of defenses.
It's very, very cool. Well, we have a question from Ned in Hale's Corners, so let's go to Ned. Hi, Ned.
Yeah, hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, it looks like spider mites. It's white spots on my magnolia tree. And I went to the garden center. They just said spray it with petroleum oil late in fall, and they're hoping that it'll all die in the winter.
Okay.
Is this true?
Well, if you're talking about white spots on magnolia trees, and are these on the twigs and branches or on the leaves mostly?
It's on the twigs and branches.
Mm.
But the leaves are turning black.
Yep.
Can actually, standing under it, you can actually feel sap dripping on you.
Yep.
You got magnolia scale.
Exactly, yeah. So this is a case of that magnolia scale insect we talked a little bit about earlier. They're bizarre-looking insects because they don't even look like an insect. They look more like a fungus. And they are dripping honeydew, which is that sap fluid that's dripping on you. When that lands on leaves, you get the sugary coating, and there is a fungus called black sooty mold, which can grow on that.
It's even in the grass underneath it.
Yeah, that sap will drip down sometimes in very, very large quantities. I don't entirely know sure why this insect is popping up, but I've had cases from across the state. It's just having a heck of a year. But now is the time to go out and do something about it, because late August and into September is when the vulnerable juvenile life stage is out. So we can go out with most of the contact insecticides. We can use a light horticultural oil. Insecticidal soap can work, although you'd have to go out a couple times spraying to make sure you get all of them. So we can do that now, late summer and early fall. If we had a severe infestation, we could go out again in the spring with what we call a dormant oil, which we apply before the buds start breaking, and that can help clean things up if there's any more around. But it sounds like it's magnolia scale rather than spider mites.
Okay. They gave me a thing to use, a hose to spray it, and it won't reach the top, the spray.
Okay.
Will the winter kill this? Winter weather?
No. So this is one of our insects that is around. It's pretty well adapted to the Wisconsin winters. So you might have some winter kill, but I wouldn't expect it to wipe them all out unless we had, you know, just another brutal winter. But anytime you get a brutal winter, I worry more about the plants surviving themselves than some of the insects.
Yeah. Yeah, so you might need to get a ladder out.
Yeah, or you can, if it's out of reach and you don't feel safe getting up on a ladder, you can always call a pest control company, a landscape pest control company. They come out. They're doing these things all the time this time in the season.
Especially this year.
Yeah.
Should I worry about it? Like, I have apple trees on the property and, you know, other nice-looking stuff, but it hasn't spread to any of that.
Right.
Should I worry about that?
This insect is specific to magnolia, so it's not going to cross over and get on apples or pine trees or anything like that. And I even have cases. It turns out this insect really can't move far. I have folks where they've got a magnolia in the front yard that has nothing on it. In the backyard, the magnolia tree is just getting hammered by magnolia scale. So they can't move very far, and they're going to stay just on magnolias.
Can you briefly run through that list of what I can use to treat it again?
Sure. So there's all kinds of landscape sprays, permethrin, bifenthrin, and related products. They often end in the letters THRIN. Those are the common ones you can get at the garden center. A light horticultural oil, insecticidal soap. If you go to the UW Extension Horticulture website, which is hort.uwex.edu, and you search for magnolia scale, we actually have a fact sheet that kind of reviews all the information about that pest. So if any listeners are interested, that's a great site to go to get information.
There we go. Thanks, okay. Ned.
Yep. Yeah. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah. Appreciate the call. Pat in Madison. Hi.
Hi. A question for you about the invasive jumping worm. I have found it in the mulchy area of our yard, and it's sort of landlocked, if you will, by our driveway. And I'm wondering if it does get over into our turf grass area, is it harmful to turf grass? And also, our neighbor had trouble establishing some new plantings right in their yard. They brought in a lot of mulch and stuff like that, and they had trouble. So I'm assuming it may be over there. Is it, you know, what kind of things is it harmful to, and is it only under mulch or in leaf litter, or does it get into the soil? Could it harm those, like the turf grass and so forth?
Yep. So these jumping worms are a fairly new invasive species, and they really started popping up in numbers last year in the state. So we know we have them in Madison area. You kind of go Madison over towards Milwaukee, that corridor. There's some up towards Appleton area, if I remember correctly. And it wouldn't surprise me if they could potentially harm turf grass. What the worms basically do is they often may come in on mulch, but they get in the soil, and they are, if you think of it this way, they're churning up the soil a lot faster than our other earthworms. And so I've talked to a couple folks this year where they are doing some landscaping and they step near a shrub or some other plant in their yard, and the soil basically caves in because it has really been chewed up and tunneled through. And the soil kind of loses its moisture holding capabilities because it's been churned up so much, and so plants get kind of dry. It's almost like a drought stress to them. So we've only been dealing this one for a short time in the state, but it wouldn't surprise me if it started affecting all kinds of plants out there.
Hmm.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot, Pat, for calling. Appreciate it. Linda, and that's a terrible, terrible problem, potentially.
Yeah.
And if it's on, and it's already a problem if it's on your in your property. Linda in Rhinelander, hello. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've noticed earwigs around my house, both inside and outside, and I'm wondering what's the best way to get rid of them. I did have a bug killer come in and spray, but it didn't seem to work.
Okay.
And then I'm looking for something that would be safe to spray both inside and outside.
Okay. So when it comes to earwigs, they are, I generally think of them as outdoor creatures, and they are very fond of kind of damp, dark locations. One of the things that can help, if you see a lot of them and you have, do you have any vegetation right along the edge of your house, hostas, lots of plants, flowers, things like that?
Unfortunately, all the way around.
Okay.
Yeah, that's your problem.
That is definitely going to play into this. If you have a gap between the plants in the house, That allows more airflow. It's going to dry things down and just make it less hospitable. But because these plants are right along the foundation, that keeps the humidity up, so the earwigs love it. It's just, you know, classic earwig territory, and they're wandering around. They love to get in cracks and crevices so they can sneak under siding, through gaps around windows and doors and things like that. So in terms of what you can do, if you do a thorough inspection and seal up any cracks or gaps with caulk or expanding foam, although sometimes that can be easier said than done, especially if you have maybe a wood siding house, there are some products that a pest control company could apply to the exterior of the house to potentially keep them out. If you're seeing them indoors, they're not going to be able to survive very well or reproduce indoors, so you probably don't need to spray indoors, but just take out the vacuum cleaner with the hose attachment and kind of suck them up is probably the best thing to do once they get in.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks, Linda. And Deborah in Brown Deer. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I sent a picture via the WPR.org, and I realize now you don't have access to those for the show. But there's this dragonfly visited and stayed resting on like a piece of mint or something in my garden in the back. But it was dark, dark gold, and it was looked more like a dragon than any other dragonfly I've ever seen, and it had like a bump. You could see this; it's a very prominent bump on the middle of its just behind its head, and it almost had like a olive green like tint to it. And if you look at the picture at some point that I sent two of them, you'll see it. But I wonder, does this sound like a familiar dragonfly to you?
Well, it's not one I can recognize based on the description. We do have a group of dragonflies. We call it the skimmer family, and they can have some species in there that can have kind of a golden color to the body or kind of a reddish gold color. Were the wings pretty transparent, or were there some black spotches on the wings at all?
Very transparent, and the whole solid, it was all solid, dark, dark, dark gold.
Okay. What I would maybe do, I'll have to try and dig or track down the pictures at some point, but if you hopped online and did an internet search for a skimmer dragonfly and just browse the images, you may find something that's close. That would be my first guess to try and narrow this down.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Back to our Facebook page, Tor sent us something. She said, I've never seen something like this before, and I don't even know how to describe this. It's sort of hairy, and I'd say different colors depending on the section of the body that it's on, but very beautiful. What do you know what it is?
Yep, so this is a creature we call the white-marked tussock moth, or white-spotted tussock moth. It is from the tussock moth family. There's a number of other species that can look somewhat similar, and they can vary in the number of whitish patches on their body and overall coloration, but it is a type of tussock moth.
It's very, very pretty. And let's see if we can find another one. Have we shown this one? This is a very large flying beetle that landed on an oak tree in June from Rich. And it's the color of the bark. Pretty much.
So this is probably one of my favorite beetles, and I don't come across it often, but we call this one the eyed click beetle. The species is Alaus oculatus, and they can be pretty good size, close to 2 inches long. They have a generally black color, but it kind of reminds me of a starry night on the wing covers because it's dark with these white spots. And behind the head, they have these two very large, distinct, and prominent eye spots, which might startle predators off that were trying to eat them.
Yeah, it's very, very cool. And then we have, I don't know, did we talk about this one? Here's a woolly aphid, a white. You know what it reminds me of? It looks like a trout fly.
It does a little bit, yeah, and this is something we call a woolly aphid. They, if you see them, they look like little bits of white lint kind of delicately floating through the air. We have some species that commonly pop up on apples, crab apples, hawthorns, and the like, and you do see them late summer here and there.
And let's see, I had one more here. Here's one from Barbara. This caterpillar recently in the Black River Falls area, this photo is from the rear, but the front had white tentacles or hairs with some black, And it's kind of a, I'd say, a light yellowish or a tan.
Mm-hmm. So we have this the yellow caterpillar, kind of fuzzy looking with some black filaments coming out. Based on the angle, what I can see, we have a group of moths that we call dagger moths, and there are some species in that group that can have this appearance. So that's my general gist of what I'm thinking of at this point. But if you hopped online and did a Google search for dagger moth caterpillar, I think we'd find some pretty close matches. And there's a number of species out there.
An email question from Jan, who says, I have a hummingbird feeder that has a lot of bees at it, and when the hummingbird comes to feed, it can't get to the feeder. It seems like the bees attack the hummingbird when it comes near. Is this true? I think probably.
Well, and it would be helpful in this case to figure out, is it actually bees? I'm a little bit more suspicious. Like, it may be something along the lines of yellow jackets.
Yeah.
And yellow jackets are the insects that this time in the year, in August and September, they are showing up at picnics and recycling bins where there's pop cans and things like that. The colonies start from scratch each year, so they build up in size. They're desperate for any type of food, and so they will go to readily available sugar sources. If you could and kind of observe and watch where the wasps or yellow jackets are going to, and you could find a nest and treat and eliminate the nest, you may be able to take it out that way.
And we have a photo from Sandy on the shore of Lake Sinisippi this year. She has a spider. Looks like a spider.
Yep, definitely a good-sized spider. I can't judge the overall length, but two things that come to mind, either a wolf spider, or we do have some of our largest spiders in the state are called fishing spiders, and they are often near bodies of water, although some can wander up into homes or a little bit farther away from water. They are good-sized insects. They are active hunters that kind of patrol around looking for prey to feed on.
Here's a very cool photo from Sue. Said, she said, this grasshopper went and wanted to ride along on my windshield. I did pull over to let him jump off. And so you've got a nice undersized side shot of this spider, and it looks like it's looking right at us, and it's with a kind of a, I don't know what you call, robot-like smile.
Yeah, I have to say that's not a view of grasshoppers you see often, having them or looking at that from below.
Very, very cool. And Phil wonders if you could identify this particular bug, and let's see if we can make it bigger. Black.
So this is a neat insect, and they can be very good size. We call these things Dobson flies. And this one appears to be a female based on the size of the mandibles. The males can look very similar, although their mandibles are very much enlarged and almost tusk-like, like elephant tusks, and they look like they could give you a heck of a pinch. These insects are associated with bodies of water. The larvae or juveniles live in streams and rivers, but the adults can emerge and then fly some distance. But if you're seeing these at your house, my bet is there is probably a body of water nearby.
And so many more. Here's maybe one more. Jesse sent one of a wasp of some sort.
Yeah, so this looks like a critter that I would call a horntail wasp or a wood wasp. They are another insect that is associated with rotting, dying trees, softwood. So they basically drill in and lay their eggs, and their larvae live there.
So lots of great photos, and what a great time today. PJ, thank you so much for being with us, and I know there's lots more up on our Facebook page. And if you haven't gotten to the page, go take a look at the page. You don't have to be a member of Facebook to look. And you can see, and there's probably maybe a few more possible identifications for you, PJ, if you have time at some point to take a look. But PJ Leash will be back, and I'm really thankful to have him with us today. And thankful to know that tomorrow we're going to learn about reptiles and amphibians and their risk of decline. And then we'll talk about UW Extension learning opportunities as well. Stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.